Thank you very much. So I took the liberty to actually remove the word loop from my title that you see in your program, because it will be about loops, but not only. So I will start out talking with something that is maybe traditionally not associated with the intensity frontier, which is about Z and W boson precision physics. But I think it's partly relevant because, you know, the techniques that I use there are also relevant for electroweak physics at lower energies. And secondly, also, I think we may be in the future entering really something that could truly be called intensity frontier on those kinds of topics.
We're already there now, right? We have millions of more of these particles.
Right, exactly. So this is a kind of overlap area, I guess.
The energy is not getting larger, right? So we are in a sense...
Unless they are time-varying fundamental constants, then maybe. <Just kidding. laughs> And yeah, but then I will also move on to talk about lower energy electroweak precision observables that are being contemplated for being measured better in the future, and finish with some comments about the muon anomalous magnetic moment, which was mentioned already earlier at this workshop. But to start out with, since I'm coming here from Pittsburgh, and since there's also a hockey stick here in the room, I cannot resist showing a picture from the Stanley Cup final. And I guess the take-home message from this scene from the final game is you can shoot a goal from behind. So this is actually the guy who shot the goal here. I don't know. What's necessary, of course, is that you have enough precision so that you still find an angle to get into the goal. And how I translate that to our field here is you can shoot to high energies from below also if you have enough precision. Okay, so to start out with the scene of Z and W boson physics, I guess, you know, all of you, you are pretty familiar with, you know, what are the relevant observables and quantities that are commonly used here. But I still kind of like to go through them briefly for the reason to see where are important corrections from theory entering. So one important quantity is the W boson mass, which within the standard model can be predicted from muon decay. So muon decay can be described by this for fermion interaction with the Fermi constant. But to keep in mind, whenever you see a value for the Fermi constant being listed somewhere, there are already radiative corrections that go into extracting those, which come from QED, so photon exchange of this sort. They are known to the two-loop level with an uncertainty that is very small. So it's probably not any source of worry, but it's still something, I think, relevant to bear in mind. And then once we have the Fermi constant, in the standard model, of course, this four fermion interaction gets expanded into a W boson exchange with its own radiative corrections. And they can be rather sizable and are usually summarized in this factor delta R here. Then there are a number of important quantities having to do with properties of the Z boson. And again, here, before you get to any of those quantities that are typically listed, say, in a PDG or so, there are a number of things that are taken out. So for instance, there are very important effects from initial state radiation. So if you have E plus, E minus going to two fermions through maybe a Z resonance, you get photon radiation in the initial state. And the effect of it is kind of shown in this plot. So what you actually measure here are these data points on this green curve. And once you deconvolute this initial state radiation, you get this, purplish curve over here, which looks very different. So it's a very big effect. And lots of people have worked on computing these effects. This is probably not a complete list here. Now, once you have removed initial state radiation, there are other things that also typically get removed, which don't have anything to do with the Z boson. So for instance, you can have a photon in the S channel, or you can have box diagrams involving, say, W bosons or something like that. So they all get subtracted, of course, assuming that the standard model is valid. But this is already potentially a point where new physics could enter. And once these things are removed, what remains is basically then the S-channel Z boson exchange, which is typically written as in this form with this Breit-Wigner line shape plus some, you know, non-resonant pieces. And one thing I always like to emphasize is if you write something like this down in a theoretically well-motivated way, these masses and widths that you see here are not what you see in the PDG or in experimental papers. There's a difference between them because for historical reasons that predate my personal existence, in experimental analyses, they use this parametrization of the cross-section, which has the extra dependence on the center of mass energy over here. And these two functions have exactly the same shape, as a matter of fact, but the parameters are different, and so there's some translation between them. So the mass that actually theoretically makes sense is 34 MeV less than what you see in the PDG. Okay, but once you have done that, you can take this cross-section with, you know, the undesirable part removed and extract a number of different observables for that. For instance, from the width of the line shape, you get the total width of the Z boson. From different final states, you can get various partial widths. From the total cross-section, you can use that. Typically, what's taken is actually not really the total cross-section, but the cross-section for the Z boson into hadronic final states. You can take ratios of these different things. And then in addition, there are various asymmetries that can be measured, which all have to do with parity violation. The most important ones, because they are best measured, are the forward-backward asymmetries, so where the final state fermions go on one or the other hemisphere, and the left-right asymmetry if you have polarized electron beams. And both of these can be expressed in terms of a quantity called the effective weak mixing angle. So this gives you basically the ratio between the vector and axial vector coupling. So these things have been measured to high precision at SLC and LEP. And there's additional data from Tevatron and from LHC that is important to get a complete picture of the standard model, in particular relating to the top quark and the Higgs boson. And remarkably, you know, all those things fit together very precisely. So what's shown here is this red blob is basically a combination of electroweak precision data, which can be used to make a prediction of the top quark mass and the Higgs boson mass. And these vertical and horizontal lines are the direct measurement of those quantities. And you can see it's an almost perfect overlap. Given the fact that these things agree well with the standard model, we can put constraints on new physics. And you can either take your favorite model to put constraints on it, or you can try to do something more model independent, like an effective field theory. So these, in the effective field theory language, the relevant operators enter at dimension 6. So these are the first dimension that matters here. And these are the operators that contribute to electroweak precision data. So some of these operators can be directly related to other things that you know about. So for instance, this directly corresponds to the T parameter. This one directly corresponds to the S parameter. This operator produces a modification of the Fermi constant. And then these operators basically change the decays of the Z boson into different fermion final states. And so there are basically not just three of them, but you can also vary the different flavors. So this is actually a large number of different operators. Actually, we have more of them than we have observables that I showed you before. So if you want to constrain all of these operators independently, you need to have some additional input. For instance, one can take some things that have been measured about the W boson, W decays, or W boson production. They are a little less precisely measured, but that's basically what we need to use. Or one can make some simplifying assumption and basically say, we assume these operators are flavor blind, so they modify all three generations in the same way. And if you do that, then electroweak precision data by itself is enough to constrain all of them. And a number of people have done that exercise. So here I show a plot from these people over here. And so down here, this is basically the allowed range for the Wilson coefficient of these operators. The green dots with error bars is what you get if you just turn on one operator at a time. And the red dots with error bars is what you get if you turn on all of them and then you marginalize over all the others. And one can translate the Wilson coefficient into a scale of new physics that you are sensitive to, assuming the new physics couples with order one coupling strength. And you can see this is somewhere in the TeV range. So these things are competitive to what we are directly probing at the LHC.
What happens with the last two on the list then? Are they not constrained individually? Is that what happens?
Why?
Why are they exactly zero with the green point with no error bar?
Oh, there's an error bar, but it's very small. So you don't
see
it.
It's exactly zero?
It's not exactly zero. No, there's a non-zero error bar, but it's too small to be seen on this plot.
Can I ask you a quick question about slide 7?
Sure.
Sorry, the.
Oh.
Yeah, this slide 7.
Oh, there's two slide 7. I'm sorry about that.
So, normally, if I was thinking about doing an electroweak fit and I renormalize in standard model, I'd be fixing G Fermi to be a given number. And then
right. This
shift from C3LL would be kind of shuffled into other numbers.
Oh.
Did I have a question?
I broke it.
Yeah,
okay.
Something.
That happens.
Oh, the chair was dead? I see. Okay. Yes.
So normally you would shift this G Fermi. You actually wouldn't compare this deviation in the effective field theory to G Fermi itself. You'd be shuffling this into some other observables.
That's correct.
That's what's being done when you show this plot on slide.
Yeah. And there are papers with many pages that work that all out. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It gets a little bit messy, but in principle, it's rather straightforward.
Okay, so it's not like that error bar that Andre was mentioning is so small because they're doing some comparison to G Fermi itself. They're doing it fully consistently.
Yes.
Okay.
But of course, I mean, the green dots are for the case where you only turn on one operator at a time, right? So, say if you turn on this operator, you have only the G Fermi modification, and that's why it's so precisely constrained. All right. Now, of course, the effective field theory language only works if you assume that the new physics is heavy, typically, you know, beyond the electroweak scale. And as a matter of fact, given the precision, we can assume, you know, maybe TeV scale or beyond. So effective theory in principle works well, but not necessarily it has to be such. We can also imagine, you know, with the mindset of the intensity frontier, maybe there's some new physics which is not that heavy, but more weakly coupled than weakly coupled, which could contribute here and could be also constrained. And I don't think people have thought about that very much. I think really for these observables, the interesting range would be somewhere between 10 and 100 GeV. 10 GeV is basically the energy scale where the B factories come in and probably do better than that. So I think it may be worth thinking about is if there's some interesting new physics that could be studied this way as well. So of course, if we have these precise experiments, these kinds of analyses only become possible if we also have sufficiently precise calculations for what we expect for these quantities in a standard model. And a lot of work has also gone into that. And again, you know, this list of references is for sure not complete. Just gives you a flavor of what has been done. But basically, the status for most of these quantities is that we have almost complete two-loop corrections for all of them. I say almost because for some of them, there's still some work to be done. Typically, what has been computed first at the two-loop level are diagrams like those one over here, where you have at least one closed fermion loop somewhere. And these are known to be dominant for two reasons. One is that if the loop involves a top quark, you can get terms that are enhanced with a top quark mass to some power. And if the loop involves a light fermion, which is basically taken massless, you get an enhancement just from the sheer number of fermions that exist in a standard model. Whereas if you have corrections that only have bosonic exchange, you don't have these enhancement factors, so all you get is basically just an alpha squared. And then there are also some partial results that are known beyond the two-loop level with three and four-loop corrections, but these are typically done in a certain approximation. For instance, where one says we only take those contributions that are enhanced by the top quark Yukawa coupling. So as an example here, you know, there's a three-loop correction with alpha s squared, so two gluon exchange inside a top loop, and that goes with the top quark mass squared. So given all these calculations, we can try to make an estimate of what the remaining uncertainty is. And for the current state of affairs, we are in pretty good shape. So these are the estimated theory uncertainties for some sample of quantities that are picked here. And these are the experimental measurements. And you see, for all of them, typically the theory uncertainty is subdominant by a factor of a few, which is kind of what we like. I should emphasize, though, that estimating theory uncertainties is not an exact science. So there are a number of methods that can be used. For instance, you can try to identify what are the missing pieces that haven't been calculated. Mostly these are various combinations of three-loop corrections. And then you can say, OK, what are known prefactors from coupling and from group theory and so on that I can identify and account these. Another thing I can do is if I have calculated a few orders already, I just try to extrapolate that series. One thing that is commonly done in QCD is if you use a scale-dependent renormalization scheme like MS-bar, you vary the scale. That unfortunately seems to work not very well for electroweak physics. I guess nobody knows exactly why, but it just, you know, the scale variation tends to be rather small, too small, basically. Or you can perform your calculation in two different renormalization schemes, say an MS-bar and an on-shell, and compare those two results. And you know, a number of these methods give comparable numbers, so we are reasonably satisfied with these estimates, I would say. But you know, that's not necessarily a theory. I should also mention that the uncertainties that you get do depend to some extent how you do your calculation. And here I just show one example for that. So there is a piece of correction which actually enters in a number of different observables in the same way. So it typically gets summarized in something called delta rho. So this is the custodial symmetry breaking part that comes from the large top quark mass. And this has been computed up to four loop order. So here, you know, these are basically corrections involving additional gluons. So there's one alpha s, two alpha s, three alpha s. And the result one gets for that depends on how you renormalize the top quark mass. So in this column, I show what you get if you renormalize the top quark mass in the MS-bar scheme. And you see that looks very nicely behaved. All the coefficients are order one. In this column, I show what you get if you renormalize the top quark mass in the on-shell scheme. And well, if I add this alpha s divided by pi, these are still getting smaller. But overall, the coefficients are significantly larger than over here. So in the on-shell scheme, you would basically have a larger uncertainty than in the MS-bar scheme. In the current situation that we have, of course, even if you use this, you cannot really completely avoid this problem, because what gets typically published by the experimental collaborations is in the on-shell scheme. So you need to translate that into MS-bar. But it may be worthwhile to consider to, you know, what is done in a few publications already to actually just keep publishing MS-bar top quark measurements. Then, besides what we actually get from missing higher orders, there are also uncertainties that enter into the prediction of the electroweak precision quantities that come from other input parameters that we need. And the most important ones of these are given here. So there's the top quark mass, which is currently claimed to be measured with an uncertainty of less than 1 GeV, both by Tevatron and LHC. I think that needs to be taken with a grain of salt, because the most precise measurement, which use some kind of distribution of final state products of the top quarks, depend on a number of things that are theoretically difficult to calculate. Especially in the generators that are typically used for that purpose, they are implemented in a relatively crude way. So there are things like, what happens to a B-jet when it fragments? Is there color reconnection between the two top quarks? How big is that? Stuff like these. Another important quantity is the W boson mass. Has currently an uncertainty of 15 MeV, which may get better at the LHC, although LHC collaboration members stopped promising anything recently, but we'll see. Then the strong coupling constant enters inside the loops, even though we talk about electroweak quantities, but in loops it appears. Here we have, in principle, a very precise measurement coming from using lattice calculations to extract it from quarkonia. Unfortunately, it's unclear whether we can really safely take that value, because there are other determinations of alpha s, like from the plus and minus event shapes or deep inelastic scattering, that give a very different value. So this hopefully will be something that can somehow be sorted out at some point. And then there's finally an additional input parameter, which is really not a fundamental input parameter, but just something that we cannot calculate, which is the shift in the electromagnetic fine structure constant, which comes from loops of light hadrons. So this is a non-perturbative effect, which is typically taken from some data. And the current uncertainty is on the order of 10 to the minus 4. With future data from E plus E minus machines, that may get better to some extent, but this may be the hardest one to improve by a lot. Which brings me to the future. So right now, we already have precise measurement of these quantities from lab and SLC, as I said, but after the Higgs discovery, there are a lot of contemplations to build a new E plus E minus collider to study the Higgs boson with high precision. And all these colliders could also run at the Z-pole again and measure those properties more precisely. And there are three main proposals that are being considered. One is the International Linear Collider, for which it's foreseen to spend around 30 adverse femtobarn of luminosity at the Z-pole. Then there's a Chinese proposal for circular E plus E minus collider, which would have a higher luminosity. And then there is a European proposal for a circular E plus E minus collider, which has an absolutely ridiculous luminosity. And it's still, the run plans are somewhat in flux, so it's not clear how much that will be. But in any case, the statistical uncertainty will be probably completely negligible. And so these various experiments estimate they can measure these electroweak precision quantities with better precision, as shown here. I don't want to spend too much time on them individually, but you can see by and large, there's about an order of magnitude or sometimes more improvement. Which means that as far as theorists are concerned, more work would need to be done, right? Because now the theory error would be larger than the experimental error, which is not satisfying. So more work needs to be done, which means one would need to compute three loop corrections. So if the most important three-loop corrections would be calculated, this is an estimate of the precision that you can achieve. And so if we compare that to the experimental precision from ILC or FCC, you can see, okay, this enters, ends up in kind of the same ballpark, which is not too bad. It's not necessarily, easy to bring it down to a level where it's really subdominant again. But in any case, it shows that a lot of work will be needed. So one could try to do even better by computing, say, for loop or something like that. At some point, though, this becomes potentially pointless, because again, these parametric uncertainties from other input parameters are also relevant. And you can see that in a number of cases, they will become dominant. Like here, for example, if you want to predict the W bows on Mars using precision measurements at ILC, you cannot get below 2-point-something MeV because you need to use the Z bows on Mars as an input. And the Z bows on Mars cannot be measured independently at ILC. So that remains at whatever it is from lab. And that limits that value, basically. Another example, if you want to, say, predict the effective weak mixing angle at FCC, I mentioned FCC has a ridiculous luminosity, so the direct measurement has a very small uncertainty. But in the prediction, we do depend on this shift in the fine structure constant, and that basically becomes a limiting factor. In addition, one should also keep in mind that just computing these quantities in the standard model is not the whole business. There are also these QED corrections that are taken out beforehand, and they will need some improvement. So if we talk about the initial state radiation effects, these are known at the full two-loop level, and then higher orders, which come from exponentiation of logarithmic effects. So there are large logarithms of the center of mass energy divided by the electron mass, which is the reason why they are so big. And so there's some amount of work that went into this. But there is a remaining uncertainty currently estimated to be about 0.1%, which is fine for lab, but it will not be fine for these future machines. And then there are also these pieces that get subtracted in order to get the pure Z boson exchange contribution. They also have some uncertainty, which is estimated to be rather small. But you know, the funny thing is, if we really think, you know, there could potentially be new physics, which is maybe lighter than the weak scale, that could enter into these pieces as well. So always important to keep in mind. Now let me move on to low energy precision observables, which is more like the vanilla intensity frontier stuff. So there's one important set of experiments which also test some of these electroweak properties, which have to do with measuring parity violating asymmetries in low energy scattering. You can have electron-electron scattering, electron-proton, or electron-deuteron scattering. All of these are experiments that actually have been performed. And they dominantly, of course, get a contribution just from QED, and that's scattering at low energies. But there's also contribution from Z boson exchange. And so basically, if you measure this with a polarized electron beam or polarized electron target, you can extract the vector and axial vector couplings. And from that, you can extract the weak mixing angle. And typically, the way this is expressed is not in terms of the effective weak mixing angle that I told you about earlier, but in terms of a low energy version of that. So there are effects which come from logarithms that are enhanced by a ratio of some heavy mass divided by the center of mass energy where you're actually doing the experiment. And they can be incorporated into a running MS bar version of this weak mixing angle. And so this is how it runs, basically. These various kinks that you see here and here come from integrating out particles at that energy scale. And so this is where LEP and Tevatron and all these experiments are doing their business. And here are various other experiments that have measured parity violation at lower energies, including the infamous NUTEF, which is a little off the line. So it's usually ignored. And right now, you see basically that all these different experiments have error bars that, if you compare them to lab, you know, they are larger by order of several. So they're not really competitive. But there are various future experiments that are being planned for electron-electron scattering, electron-proton scattering, and also atomic parity violation. And these are the error bars that are anticipated for those experiments. So this is electron-electron, electron-proton, this is also electron-proton, and this is atomic parity violation. Don't look at where they are positioned here, right? I mean, this is not, we don't expect to measure this value. This is just to illustrate the error bars they produce. And those you can see, they are actually competitive with what we have over there. So what can we learn from that? Well, first of all, the fact that it's considered that we have different targets that we can look at, electrons, protons, and so forth, would allow us to actually test the interactions of the Z boson to different fermions in the standard model. So this is kind of illustrated over here. So in this plane, this is a little hard to see, but so over here, this shows a combination of effective couplings to if you have electrons that you scatter off up and then minus down quarks, and here's another combination with the same with a plus sign. So if you have one experiment, you just get some band in this plane. But of course, if you have several experiments, these bands will overlap at some point, and then you can constrain both of these couplings individually. And here's another example for a different combination. So this is one advantage we can get from the combinations of these various experiments. Another thing we can do is, assuming that new physics doesn't come from high energies, but maybe from lower energies, we can have better sensitivity to certain types of new physics at these experiments than we have at, say, lab. The classic example that is always being presented is the dark photon. So this is a new gauge boson that kinetically mixes with the photon. It was popular for some time because it could explain potentially the G minus 2 discrepancy, although that parameter space gets constrained. So this is the effect you would get from such a dark photon on this running effective weak mixing angle. So the black line is the standard model, and then the blue and the red are two examples for different assumed masses of this dark photon.
This is not what people would normally call the minimal dark photon. So this is with an additional assumption of mass mixing with the Z.
Right, there's also mass mixing.
Otherwise, it's parity conserving, right? So.
Right. There's also mass mixing. Yes, sorry, I forgot to mention that. Yes. So there's kinetic mixing and mass mixing.
Yeah, it's a dark photon, and I just force a little bit of a mixing of the Z with the Z beyond what normal dark photon do. So it's somehow with artificially enhanced fairly well.
Right. But even if you have the pure dark photon only with kinetic mixing, it would give a contribution too, because you measure an asymmetry ratio, so it changes the denominator. So you can constrain that as well. I mean, this plot is for what you just said, that's correct. But
this would be the denominator is so much dominated by the normal QED scattering that modifying denominator doesn't do much for you. See what
well,
I'm saying? You measure asymmetry.
It's a matter of precision, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're never going to extract weak scale type interactions from a denominator, from modifying the rate itself. You have to have new physics that breaks parity.
I mean, you don't get the same level of precision for that. I agree, but yeah. Nevertheless, you know, there is an effect in principle. So this is, anyway, so this vector boson that mixes with standard model stuff is the case that normally is considered. I think, you know, it may be worth also thinking about, are there other motivated or not motivated new physics scenarios of light new particles that could be tested this way? I think the experimentalists who are planning these experiments would be very interested in, you know, getting more ideas on that. So again, of course, as for Z and W boson physics, these experiments depend on having precise theoretical predictions. So what's the status over here? So I'm starting out just to focus on electron-electron scattering because that is cleaner than the electron-hadron scattering. And so for that, we have complete electroweak one-loop corrections that were computed. And they produce a very large effect of about 40%. But there are actually reasons for this that can be understood. One reason has to do with this running weak mixing angle. So if you define your mixing angle not at a Z scale, but at a low energy scale, that already takes out the majority of these corrections. Then you get an order 10% effect. That still looks relatively large for something that's electroweak. But the reason for that is that the tree-level contribution is just very small. You're scattering electrons, and the contribution to the asymmetry that you get is proportional to 1 minus 4 times the mixing angle, which is just a very small number. So any modification has a big effect. In the running of this weak mixing angle, you get these logarithms, which depend on whatever particles are in the loop relative to what's the highest scale you actually want to run up to. As for the case of the fine structure constant, if you go to sufficiently low energies, this becomes non-perturbative for the quarks. So basically, instead of quarks, you need to think about hadrons running in the loop. So this has been tried to evaluate it by basically taking the known result for the fine structure constant and, you know, fudging some translation. It seems like the effect is relatively small, so by now people are sufficiently happy about this, but, you know, it may deserve a closer look. Then there are also some higher order corrections that were computed, but so far really only for the running effects of this mixing angle, which of course is the dominant correction, but nevertheless, that's the only higher order part that's known. So what is not known are the genuine electroweak corrections that you get to the process itself for the matrix elements. And you know, some people say they should be small, but you never quite really know because, you know, we saw that the one loop effects were large. So the leading contributions from the two loop effects maybe are suppressed by another order of magnitude. But that would still be relevant for the anticipated experimental uncertainty, which is also at the percent level.
You want to do electron-electron scattering? Or
yes.
Because in electron-proton, there are all these proton
it's
structure,
worse.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes. This is my next comment, which I think Andrei will talk about later today anyway. So I'm not too much an expert on that and won't talk much about it. But if you have electron-proton scattering, of course, then you have additional QCD and hadronic effects on the hadronic side, which make things even harder. I want to mention something about this running mixing angle here, because so this is a convenient quantity to parameterize those low energy results with. But one thing to keep in mind is that this is actually a gauge-dependent quantity, because we are integrating out incomplete multiplets of SU2. One way to fix that, which some people like to advocate in the past, is to add in additional pieces that fix the gauge dependence using the pinch technique. So the pinch technique basically takes vertex and box diagrams and modifies them into a self-energy-like topology. That's rather cumbersome, though, if you want to do it, say, at a two-loop level. I don't think that will be a good way forward. Probably more practical is just to accept the gauge dependence of this quantity, and we should all agree on using, say, the Feynman gauge or something like that. So this is not theoretically very elegant, but I guess that's would still work. So finally, I want to say a few things about the muon anomalous magnetic moment. I don't have any, revolutionary insight into that. But so, as you all know, this has been measured not by NBL, but BNL. with great precision using a muon storage ring, and will be remeasured at Fermilab and JPARC with even better precision. And then we can compare what we get from theory. And well, there are very large corrections from theory which mostly come from QED. But an impressive amount of work has been invested into computing these QED corrections up to 5-loop with this. This is just a subset of the diagrams, tens of thousands of them. And this is the prediction you get. Then there are also electro weak corrections. The effect of them is much smaller because they are suppressed by mu over the weak scale. And there are also hadronic corrections, which again are mostly non-perturbative. So the traditional way of dealing them is, again, we use data from E plus E minus scattering and then do some translation using a sorry, I'm missing the word right now. You know what I mean. into these processes. And so they have been, of course, computed for these contributions where you have the hadronic vacuum polarization directly in a single photon exchange. But then there are also higher order effects where you have additional photons. Or maybe one hadronic and one leptonic loop, or two hadronic loops, and all that stuff. So these are these various contributions over here. They come with uncertainty, of course, because the data has some uncertainty. And then there's another hadronic contribution, which unfortunately we cannot take from measurements, so we can only estimate using models. This is this light by light contribution, where you have in total 4 photons coupling to a hadronic loop. And this also has some uncertainty. But even given all those uncertainties, oops, oh, this is an old value, sorry. Here's a newer value. I forgot to update that on both slides. Even taking all those uncertainties, if you compare theory to experimental prediction, you get a deviation of more than 3 standard deviations. And so what do we make of that? One possibility is to say, well, maybe those uncertainties, especially for those hadronic pieces, are underestimated. And you know, there's some arguments to support that statement, because some of the plus and minus data that is being used here is rather old, from old experiments, which were done, you know, with different methods than are used in modern experiments. It was also realized at some point that there is an important contribution coming from photon row mixing. This is important when, instead of E plus E minus data, you want to use tau decay data. So that enters there in an important way. And so basically, if you compare what you get from tau data to what you get from E plus E minus data as a function of the energy, before this correction was implemented, you got a picture like this, where, you know, at low energies it's all nicely compatible with 1, but then it deviates. And after this correction was implemented, now everything is compatible with 1. So there may those, you know, this may be not the only hadronic effect here correction that needs to be implemented. One can wonder about that. And then, as I already mentioned, the light by light contribution we cannot take from data anyways. So this just comes from hadrons. One fortunate thing, though, is that maybe lattice will come to the rescue. So a lot of work has been already invested into computing both the vacuum polarization as well as the light-by-light contribution on the lattice. Right now, the uncertainties are still larger by a factor of a few compared to these things. But maybe at some point, we will get there that they become at the same level, and then, you know, we know what's going on there in the hadronic sector. The other contribution possibility is, of course, that this discrepancy actually comes from some new physics beyond the standard model. And as I briefly alluded to already, so one possibility that was popular for some time is that this dark photon could play the role. So this is a simple diagram like this. Because this dark photon is light, you get a relatively large contribution. larger than potentially what comes from electroweak physics. So this green band would be the parameter space in terms of mass and mixing parameter that could explain this discrepancy. And this is not the newest plot here even, but you can see this is, I think, 2 years old or something like that. Already here, pretty much most of the parameter spaces constrained by other experiments that have tried to look for this particle. One can, of course, modify the theory a little bit and say there may be non-standard model decays of this dark photon, then it would still be allowed.
Oh, it actually is here, even if it decays invisibly, it's being ruled out by the search of Pomar of plus and minus going to.
But not over the whole mass range, right?
Over the whole
mass range? Yes. I see, okay.
So even now that.
Okay, very good. So it's just dead.
Yeah, it's just more dead than.
More dead, yeah. So you have to come up with a more exotic decay, basically, yeah. The other possibility is that it potentially comes from heavy new physics. So particles that have masses above the electroweak scale. That is also not, you know, terribly easy to achieve because in order to get a large enough correction, these particles then need to have order one coupling strength. And so this means this is stuff that can be tested at existing colliders like the LHC, because you have particles of a few hundred GeV with order one coupling strength, so they have large production cross sections. So here's basically some translation of the parameter space that you want to get in order to explain G minus 2, then to what the LHC can test. So in all of these scenarios, basically, you introduce typically two new particles in order to make a new physics loop. So there's one bosonic and one fermionic particle, say a scalar and a fermion, or a vector and a fermion, like this. And so these plots show the two masses of those particles. Here, this is for fermion and scalar. Here, this is for fermion and a different SU2 representation and scalar. Here's for fermion and vector, and so forth. And these various lines show what can be constrained from existing new physics searches at the LHC. So those are searches that are not dedicated to finding these particular particles for this particular problem, but they can be recast for that purpose. And the dashed lines that you see in some examples is how this could be approved with 300 inverse femtobarn at the LHC. And you can see that with the exception of maybe this example over here, pretty much all of the parameter space can be constrained by the LHC at some point. So looks promising that this will be a scenario that can be actually tested with data that's coming in. Now, there are caveats to this. If you introduce a complex new physics sector like the MSSM, there are more possibilities to enhance the contribution. In the case of MSSM, you can use tangent beta as a parameter that enhances the new physics effect and might push them beyond what the LHC can reach. All right, I mean, that's pretty much what I wanted to say.
Can I ask one question before?
Absolutely.
What were the couplings there in that plot?
The couplings in that plot, they were basically set by, let me try to remember. Right, so it was basically assumed that these couplings are perturbative. So we put an upper bound on those couplings, and then, you know, these are the regions, you know, how far you can go out in mass in order to still explain G minus 2. For the LHC, actually, the couplings between these new physics particles is not important, because production will dominantly proceed through gauge interactions, and then the coupling strength is set by that. All right, so I think it's fair to say that electroweak precision physics either is already or may in the future move into the intensity frontier, depending how you define that term. And so this is very interesting because you can constrain new physics at the multi-TeV level, potentially beyond to what direct searches at colliders can do. And I think something that we should continue thinking about is also how we can constrain different types of super weakly coupled, not so heavy new physics in that way. There may be actually already a hint towards beyond the standard model physics from G-2, but maybe it's also because we don't understand all the systematics sufficiently well there. What we also should keep in mind is then when we move to a future high precision era, just one observable that is measured more precisely doesn't help us because we need other inputs. So they need to be all improved in parallel. And finally, since we want to have discussions here, I kind of listed some of these things that I discussed during the talk, which are still open questions. So there's more work done for future experiments for theorists to compute the standard model predictions. There could be more work done to think about what new physics could be tested as these experiments, and maybe also some more work about how we can parameterize this new physics in a way that is as model independent as possible. So for heavy new physics, we of course know the effective theory language, but the question is for light new physics, maybe one can also come up with some effective descriptions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Various claims about this or that particular observable sort of getting out of the line, like slack
symmetry
points towards, I forgot, it pulls in another way
right.
than Z branching to B's and so on.
Is
this now viewed as like not a big deal? That this is
no, this is still
consistent, or is it a little bit worse?
No, this is still same as it was before, an open question. So yeah, that's the problem that exists is, so there's a measurement of basically the leptonic effective weak mixing angle from using polarized beams, so the left-right asymmetry at slack, and using the forward-backward asymmetry with bottom quark final states at lep. Now, of course, you may wonder, there's a difference between the two observables. One involves bottom quarks. Is there some new physics, maybe in the bottom quarks, that could be responsible for that? That is very hard to achieve, because just the way the standard model parameters work out is that the forward-backward asymmetry is actually dominated by the effect of the initial state, so the electron z vertex. The contribution from the z bottom vertex is actually small. So if you want to introduce some new physics that accounts for that, it would enter at the tree level. Otherwise, the effect is too small. And it's hard to come up with a new physics model that really has an effect at tree level here, is not constrained by something else. So most people think, it's really difficult to explain with new physics, and maybe there's some experimental effect that has been underestimated, that there are larger uncertainties. I think right now, really, since LEP and SLC are both turned off, we cannot really gain much more insight about this. It may be potentially interesting to watch what comes out from the LHC, as a matter of fact. So the LHC is not able to measure the leptonic effective weak mixing angle with better precision than LEP, but just to see where it falls, closer to one or closer to the other, may be interesting to see.
So you mentioned these low energy observables, such as the Moeller experiment and EP. And when you did so, you discussed this non-perturbative contribution coming from gamma zeros.
Right.
And you mentioned that this is under, or at least it's considered to be under pretty good control. When you mentioned it on your slides, you talked about fitting it to quark masses.
That's actually what has been done, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, we heard a talk the other day where in the context of neutrino physics, this was considered too old-fashioned for modern usage.
Yeah, I mean...
Do you have a comment on maybe more detail about how this is done and whether it's something that should be revisited for these future parity-violating experiments?
Yeah, I should not... So this is...
There's an additional non-perturbative piece coming. Instead of gamma-gamma, it's a gamma-z mix.
Right. So this is from diagrams like this. So they contribute to the running of this MS-bar mixing angle. Right. Yeah, and actually, so what has been done, and I didn't participate in that, so I don't know, you know, all the details about it. But yeah, what has been done is they basically took the measurement of, and not the measurement, the evaluation of the fine structure constant as a function of scale, which of course you can take, you know, from various publications, and then they fit that using just a perturbative calculation with quark masses, and they fit the various quark masses to get, you know, as good a fit to this as possible, and then they use those quark masses to compute those diagrams, basically. I agree, to my personal taste, this doesn't feel quite right. I think it probably would be better to, you know, directly use some kind of dispersion relation or so to take it directly from the data. I don't know if there's some difficulty in doing that. I'm not sure. I think the reason why overall people are, you know, reasonably comfortable with this at this point is because, as I said, the contribution of it is not terribly large. So, like, for alpha, the shift from hadronic effects is rather big, right? But it seems like here it's not that big. But still would be nice to do it in a more proper way.
And in the case I was describing, it was lacking even any constraint like this, right? Had to pick something for a quark mass to...
Well, normally what they did back then, I think I knew the papers you're referring to, they would basically take, I mean, people used to fit this hadronic contribution to alpha. Just using the actual data, they'd publish some parameterized form, and I think the papers you referred to, they would just adjust their quark masses to match that parameterized form. So there was some kind of constraint there.
Dittmeier
used to do that all the time.
Yeah,
and he used
do
to do
this in electrophysics.
Right, but he used to do it correctly. I mean, there was some, you know,
handle on that. Yeah, what we do is we just extract it in the EFs. In the 20-minute. It's just a different, you have different counter terms. We just use the masses as a regulator instead of...
He would use it for the actual running of alpha as well. He would actually put
that's
the
other part,
out.
But I think what Kevin, which was showing the log MQ...
Oh, it would be for the PDF
normalization. The radiation population.
Yeah, that's even worse.
Mm. Yes.
Well, you know, the Bardeen people, so if we do this, we just use a different regulator, right? So you have counter terms from the PDFs and you absorb them like you do in one life cell tools, right? From initial state radiation. But what they did, I think they just kept the logs, and they tried to give it some physical meaning, so that it actually had these logs.
Well, I mean, in practice, right? I mean, in practice, you could pick a broad variety of masses and
that's
didn't really
do
much of anything, but it was still a little unsavory.
Yeah.
But just for this one, it's small enough. People think that it's just a small enough a contribution that it's not worth doing it.
I think, yeah. Again, that might actually change in the future, right? So I should look again what the uncertainty from these things is. But you know, if it comes somewhat close to percent level, you might wonder about it, right? Because if the method is somewhat not exceedingly well motivated, then the error that's estimated may be also off, right? Yeah. I think part of the problem, you know, getting this directly as a dispersion relation from data is, of course, well, up here you need not only the vector, but you need the axial vector coupling, which the plus and minus data is not providing. So I don't know what could be done about that.
Tau data, so?
Maybe. yeah. Would be worth considering, yeah.
Any other questions?
The Brookhaven G minus two experiment was claimed to be limited mostly by statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And Fermilab experiment using the same similar technique is going to prove that maybe factor two or more.
I think they claim factor four, I believe, yeah.
So assuming since they're using the same technique, let's say they get same result.
Same central value. Yeah.
What are you going to conclude?
I mean, if both of those experiments really get the same central value, one can probably say, okay, you know, that is the value there.
Wouldn't be surprising since they're using very similar technique, basically, at Fermilab.
Yeah, so at Fermilab, one can still say, well, yeah, they maybe, you know, transported some of the errors over from BNL, but, you know, at JPark, they use a completely different machine, though.
I don't think they were limited by systematics.
That's what they say, right? But of course, you can take an extremely radical approach and say, well, you know, let's just assume, you know, anything needs to be revisited, which I'm not, you know, I don't have any indication for that, but you can take that approach. Then, you know, if you have a completely different machine in Japan, you know, that would be extremely unlikely.
They're aiming for the level of precision of the Brookhaven experiment.
Right, but that's already pretty far away from the standard model prediction, right?
In the future.
Yeah, a long time, I know.
Based on the theoretical analysis, would you conclude that you have non-standard model physics based on
Not yet, but if we get those lattice results with a precision that's comparable to the other evaluation, then I think, you know, we would at some point run out of other options, yeah.
But it's 3 sigma.
3 point something, yeah, depending who you ask.
Well, but
yeah.
What is theoretical sigma?
Yeah, and the experimental sigma will go down, right? So, I mean, just saying it's a statistical fluctuation will, after Fermilab data is in, will probably not be quite viable anymore. I mean, this could go up to 5 sigma, basically.
The central point can get closer, right?
Oh, yeah. If the central point moves, then we'll see, right? But his question was assuming the central point stays exactly where it is.
Yeah, maybe it does for a change. But any other questions? Thank you very much.